I once wrote something which pleased Anthony Lowenstein, and that pleased me very much. He is a journalist, he is an author. His last book was Prophets of Doom, How Vulture Capitalism is Swallowing the World. He's also written about blogging and two books about the situation in Palestine. Welcome to the show once again, Anthony Lowenstein.
Thanks so much for having me, Peter. How are you?
Are you in East Jerusalem?
I am. I am now living here. I just moved here recently, and it's lovely and fascinating and dark and all the kind of other things you'd expect in occupied territory.
You were living in Sudan, weren't you?
I was. So in 2015, I was living in South Sudan for the year, which was challenging and interesting,
yes.
And now I've moved here. So, yeah, at the moment, Australia is very far away, which I'm fine about for the moment.
How is the situation in Palestine? What of the two-state solution, Anthony? Is it dead?
I think it was never really going to be a starter, to be honest. Mm. I mean, it's a long answer to that, but in short, look, there was the recent anniversary of the Oslo Peace Accord, and there was talk, of course, about the viability of a two-state solution, a Jewish state and a Palestinian state, which could be Muslim or Christian.
Yes.
And the facts on the ground in the West Bank and indeed in around East Jerusalem make any kind of viable separation of the territory. I don't think it's a question of arguably impossible. It is impossible. It would be the desire of people. As I might add, the problem is not just the political stuff.
Anthony, you're breaking up. Stay still.
Is that better?
Yeah, it's better. Yes, thank you. Keep going.
The issue is not just the Israeli political establishment, it's also the Palestinian one, the Palestinian Authority is a sadly bloated, corrupt entity which receives huge amounts of Western aid, including from Australia,
yes.
And there's a great deal of evidence to show that, in fact, it's been happy to pocket that money rather than actually pushing forward that negotiation.
Mm.
But the reality of the lack of a two-state solution means that in practice you have an unofficial one state, which is discriminatory and apartheid, where there's one rules for Arabs and one rules for Jews.
Yes.
And growing numbers of Jews and people realise that, but sadly many political leaders, including Australia, I mean, you may remember, listeners may recall a few years ago, Julie Bishop, our foreign minister, and
The phone line is a bit dodgy, Anthony. What a shame. I don't know what to advise. We'll persevere. Is there no landline there, Anthony?
There's not. No, is that better?
Dear. That is a bit better. Yes, we'll keep going. Before we get off Palestine, as I've often quoted, and I went there with Nick Xenophon and a party of people, Senator Nick Xenophon said, why does the world believe the International Court of Justice and its rulings on whaling and yet disbelieve the International Court of Justice and its constant rulings on Palestine?
It's a good question. I think Israel is the ultimate example of a country that played by its own rules. I mean, there have been countless rulings in the International Criminal Court, every human rights group in the world, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, the UN and others, have found the occupation, which began in 1967, which of course means that in 2017, next year, it's 50-year anniversary of an occupation. Now, no one can say after 50 years that such a thing is temporary. It's permanent.
Mm.
It's not an occupation for many Israelis. And in fact, if you speak to a lot of Israelis, both within government and elsewhere, they're resigned to the fact and they support the idea of an indefinite status quo. But if you accept the status quo, then you're willing to accept the fact that Palestinians don't have equal rights.
Mm.
So why is the ICC ignored? It's ignored because there's little or no pressure for Israel to abide by its rulings.
Mm.
Where is that pressure coming from? Nowhere. The US certainly has accepted Israel's rulings. So, yeah, it's a difficult situation.
I encourage, as you are well aware, and so am I, do people think about a small country, I think four times the size of Kangaroo Island, Israel and Palestine, and imagine 750 kilometres of an 8-metre-high concrete wall. Imagine if you woke up, dear listener, tomorrow and there was an 8-metre-high concrete wall on your fence line. So your driveway and front door is now useless. This is what many thousands of people, the conditions under which many thousands of people are living.
Well, millions, in fact. I mean, the great tragic irony is that the wall that Israel has built, which it claims was to stop suicide bombers, actually was not built on any kind of internationally accepted line or border between Israel and Palestine. It deliberately goes deep inside Palestinian territory and cuts off towns in the middle. So one can visit villages and towns, and a high, as you say, concrete wall literally goes between people's areas, within their areas. And I think ultimately this really is coming to a situation, and a lot of people argue this, including in Australia, that how South Africa during apartheid was treated, increasing boycotts and sanctions, is exactly where Israel is going. And the reason that happened with apartheid South Africa, as listeners will remember, if they're old enough to remember, is that the political process failed. Initially, there was no real sense that the US or the UK or Australia, for that matter, was going to do anything about it. In the end, of course, there was a political process with Mandela and others, but for decades there was literal no refusal of South African apartheid. That is exactly what's happening with Israel, and there are growing moves to boycott and sanction.
Anthony Lowenstein, journalist and writer in Palestine. It would not surprise you, Anthony, as I was told, that the Americans spent $20 billion on air conditioning during the Afghan war. $20 billion air conditioning their various buildings and barracks and houses and so forth. Does that stun even you, Anthony?
No, it doesn't, actually. I have spent a lot of time in Afghanistan in the last years, and both for a book that just came out called Disaster Capitalism and a film of the same name, which is hopefully going to be finished this year. And what you find is that the US has spent, since 2001, when they invaded in October, over $110 billion just on aid projects, so-called nation building. The vast majority of that money has disappeared, and Australian money in exactly the same situation. And what really stuns me is how little interest or accountability there is in the US or in Australia. Australia occupied Afghanistan for years. The areas where Australian troops were based are now mostly controlled by the Taliban.
With a record heroin crop.
Absolutely. Well, heroin, of course, is one of the great, in some ways, untold stories of that war, where the US and Australia, for that matter, mostly turned a blind eye to the fact that Afghanistan is now the world's greatest supplier of poppies and heroin and opium. Myanmar is number two, far, far below Afghanistan.
And when we left that year, the war ended, in inverted commas, we left the best heroin crop in years.
And you wonder, therefore, why no Australian Prime Ministers or Defence Ministers or anyone with any serious position has been held accountable for that. And that's Labor and Liberal. This is not a partisan comment. It's both major sides of politics have been equally useless on this question. And I fear that we're yet again moving to a situation where we're now bombing Syria and we're bombing Iraq, and the same kind of problems that we faced years ago are happening again now. I would say an unenlightened amnesia within our political process, and the media is often complicit in that, because the press often goes along by embedding with Australian and foreign troops in these countries and doesn't ask enough serious questions about what we're doing there and what we're achieving or otherwise.
You've gone from prophets of doom, vulture capitalism, to disaster capitalism, because in prophets of doom you wrote about, I think, Haiti, I recall, and PNG, and so you've developed that, and it's a film and a book, Anthony.
It is. So the the book Disaster Capitalism certainly covers some similar areas of Prophets of Doom, but it also expands into the US and the UK as well, particularly focusing on privatised immigration, which has become one of the great areas of growth in the economic cycle in the last 20 years. And obviously the European refugee crisis in the US and elsewhere is increasing that. And the film is a work in progress. I'm working with an American filmmaker. The film covers Afghanistan, Haiti, and Papua New Guinea. People can Google it. They can just put in disaster capitalism film. They'll find the trailer. And as I said, we're editing the feature at the moment and hope to have it out sometime later on this year.
Anthony Lowenstein, you're very mobile, kiddo.
Very mobile, and mostly because I don't really feel, for me at least, as a journalist who writes on these issues, that Australia is the place to be at the moment. It's sadly, it feels very far away and distant from.
Why do you feel that? Why do you feel that?
I think Australia is, with notable exceptions, so please don't take this personally, it is proudly parochial. Proudly parochial. And having said that, the majority of media in America and the UK is the same. It's not particularly about Australia. It's about the kind of issues, I guess, that I'm writing about and where I'm investigating, not about Australia. The main issue I have focused on Australia in the last 10 years, and it's featured in my last book, is immigration and the privatised nature of that. That is definitely something I still write about and talk about and investigate. So it's not a question of disinterested in what's happening to my home country. It's more a sense that the work has taken me elsewhere, and Australia feels very far away from that for now.
But you will take solace in the fact that Christopher Pyne has criticised Donald Trump's campaign, and this is horrified by Donald Trump's campaign and his comments on immigration.
Well, I'm so touched by Christopher Pyne's comments, and hopefully if Christopher's listening, he'll be rapt to hear that he's been a member of a government who has caused untold misery on immigrants and refugees in the farm setting in the last year. So I'd say he'd be the last person who should be speaking about refugees or Donald Trump, in my personal humble view.
Anthony Lowenstein, who is a journalist and is in Palestine. Where do you go next? You're the only person I've ever known who's been to Guinea-Bissau.
I was there a few months ago. Well, I'm based here for a while, and I'm working on a new book at the moment, which I can't really talk about, but I'm travelling to various places this year, but based here for a while.
You don't get into trouble. You're a Jew, Anthony, but you don't get into trouble because of your views in Israel?
Well, I probably would. I mean, to be honest, I'm living with my partner in East Jerusalem and spending time in Israel proper as well for work and others. And look, I think in Israel itself, there is a sadly tiny and shrinking minority of Jews who share my outlook and my perspective. And what's sad to see is that there is a growing campaign by the Israeli government against groups like Breaking the Silence and others. This is Israeli Jewish groups. I've got no personal association with these groups at all, but they are being targeted in an attempt to try to shut them down. The dissent within Israel, forget about Palestine, talking about within Israel, is seen as a threat. And that, to me, is a sign of a country that is increasingly belligerent, but also feels it can act without any kind of real pressure against it. So when you start trying to shut down dissenting Jewish groups within Israel, then I think you have a serious question about how you actually see democracy, if at all.
We're aware of many many Jews supporting the Palestinian cause, Anthony. You're certainly no orphan there, but you feel they're being shut down in Israel.
Well, it's not really an opinion. I mean, having been here and also following the story very closely, there are some leading dissenting Jewish organizations. I mean, for those Breaking the Silence, I encourage listeners to Google them. Breaking the Silence was started by former Israeli soldiers.
Yes, I know. I've met with them.
Exactly, hardly raving lefties.
No.
Basically, it's saying that when they are operating in the West Bank and Gaza, when they're serving with the IDF, they are routinely committing abuses, and they think that sort of information should be shared. They have a large audience internationally. They tour, they speak, they write books and articles, but within Israel itself, particularly in the last 6 or 12 months, and other organisations too, there is massive pressure, both from the Israeli government, Netanyahu, but also far-right groups that are funded by Netanyahu's government, to shut them down, to infiltrate them, to say that they are traitors. And when you start having people talking about groups being traitors and violence against them, that to me is a sure sign that democracy does not exist.
These
and that is a real problem.
Former Israeli soldiers who have risen up and said, we were being asked to do things that we cannot conscience. And
absolutely.
Within a system we cannot conscience. And they have spoken out very heroically and honestly, haven't they?
Well, they have, and they continue to do so, despite the fact that they are under massive pressure to not do so. And the other issue here is that Netanyahu and many of his allies received funding from far-right American Jewish organization. Sheldon Adelson is one of the most famous. He's a Las Vegas casino billionaire. So he receives huge amounts of money regularly from Adelson and others. But apparently some groups that are critical that receive, yes, some funding from Europe particularly, Threat and Asylum does, that apparently is beyond the pale and should be banned. So you really get a sense of that kind of belief that dissent is seen as being traitorous, and that to me is very worrying.
Anthony Lowenstein, my guest. Anthony, tomorrow night I'm interviewing the Grand Chief, Sir Julius Chan, former Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea. What would you have me ask him?
Well, I've recently seen that he's released a book. I guess that's what you're talking
about,
I presume. And I'm going to choose my words very carefully here, but he was directly involved at a time where Bougainville, the Papua New Guinean province, was consumed by a civil war, essentially a war between Rio Tinto, the mining company, the Papua New Guinean government, the Australian government, and the Bougainvillians who rose up against that mine. When his book came out recently, I saw some quotes for the ABC of him defending the use of a foreign mercenary group to try to kill and attack Bougainvillians. Having spent time in Bougainville, most of my work was not directly about Julius Chan per se, but the idea that even still in 2016 we are denying, we being him and others, this, I would see this as violent denial of reality, of the, what happened in that place. Was one of the most brutal and violent civil wars in our part of the world for decades.
I want to ask him why his country is so violent.
Well, interesting. I'm not sure what he would say to that. I think I would argue, having spent a lot of time there in the last years, that Australian aid has a lot to answer for. And in fact, Australian aid really, although partly definitely does help individuals in Papua New Guinea, but definitely some of it does. But a lot of that aid to me is about one thing and one thing only, supporting Australian mining companies to have access to Papua New Guinea's natural resources. And the effect of those resource projects, Bougainville and elsewhere, has been utter devastation for local people. And it's sad. It's sad that Chan and many other Papua New Guinean leaders are allowed to sprout these views without any kind of accountability, morally or legally. The serious questions about what he was doing during his time in government, I don't want to go into too much detail live on air about that, but there is great evidence, questioning evidence, about what him and others were doing when they were in power in relation to Bougainville. Kind of country where there was accountability, someone like him could well be facing some kind of trial. So maybe ask him in some way that you can.
All right. Thank you, Anthony. I wish you well, Anthony. Always good to speak with you. Keep safe, old boy.
I appreciate it.
We need you.
I will.
And all the best to you. Thank you. Anthony Lowenstein, journalist.